Besides, she was the only real friend I had in Portland, and soon I would be gone. She chose a sports-themed bar close to the office that included multiple television screens. Sports paraphernalia hung on the walls and drooped from the ceiling. I guessed the bar was popular because the tables filled quickly. We found a couple abandoning an elevated table with two tall chairs a safe distance from the televisions and quickly grabbed it. The waitress, dressed in a black and white referee shirt and cheek-hugging black shorts, quickly descended on us for drink orders. She set down cocktail napkins and advised that it was happy hour. Appetizers were just a few dollars. Devin ordered hummus and flatbread and an olive plate. Just the thought of food made my queasy stomach churn. "Two lemon drops," Devin said to the waitress, raising her voice over the din of the crowd. "I'm good," I said, shaking my head. "Just water."
"Come on, we're celebrating."
Devin snatched the drink menu and handed it to the waitress, who departed.
"What exactly are we celebrating?"
"Your return to work."
"I'm back because we had to file bankruptcy."
"I know, but I'm still glad to have you back. It wasn't the same without you. I don't know how I survived the boredom."
"Listen," I said, "thanks for being there for me, for letting me unload all my problems on you."
Devin waved it off.
"It's no big deal."
"It is. It meant a lot to me. I'm sorry I lost touch when I left. You're my only real friend here."
"That's not true," she said.
"It is. You're the only person I've ever been able to count on."
"Well, I missed not having you around," she said.
I smiled at that.
"You mean the girl who goes home every night and sticks her nose in a book?" She laughed.
"Okay, so tell me, have you heard from the attorneys about your trust? Are the creditors going to be able to get at it?"
I don't know what compelled me. Maybe it was just the need to tell someone because keeping it a secret had consumed me. "I'm not waiting for the attorneys," I said.
"What?"
"I can't risk losing my trust, Devin."
"What do you mean?"
"I've hidden it."
"How?"
"I opened bank accounts in a different name."
"How did you do that?"
"I can't say how. I'm sorry. I just can't."
"That's okay. Wow. So you think it's safe?"
"It should be. I'm still in the process of doing a couple of things."
"Where did you learn how to do it?"
I gave a small laugh.
"Where else?"
"A book."
"So you just made up a name?"
"Not exactly, no."
"So you, like, have an alias?"
"I guess so."
"Do you have a driver's license?"
Devin asked, animated. "I needed one to open the account."
Devin leaned forward, wide-eyed.
"Did you use a famous person's name?"
"No, I used a pretty lame name, actually."
Two young men in business suits, ties lowered and top shirt buttons undone, approached our table and Devin sat back. They were cute. One had sandy blonde hair and a shy grin. The other sported one of those trendy two-day growth beards and a lot of attitude, like Graham when I first met him. With summer nearing, a lot of the businesses hired college interns. These two didn't look much older.
"My friend and I were hoping you could settle a bet," Mr. Two-Day Growth said, which caused Devin to give me a sidelong glance and a roll of her eyes.
"What's that?"
she said, playing along.
"I'm betting you're in town for the Nike CrossFit Games."
He jabbed a thumb at the Brad Pitt lookalike.
"He says your local's out for a drink."
"What happens if you're both right?"
Devin said.
"We both buy you a drink," he said, smiling.
The blonde looked at me with a sheepish grin.
"Are you the CrossFit competitor?"
"Me?" I said, hoping I wasn't blushing.
"God, no."
"Well, you look like you could be." He flashed a boyish grin that ran straight through me.
The waitress returned with our two lemon drops. Devin said,
"Seems we already have drinks, and we haven't seen each other in a while. We're trying to catch up. But thanks."
I was surprised Devin blew them off, which wasn't like her. Unlike me, she relished attention, and she wasn't married. I almost sensed Devin was peeved that I'd been the one mistaken for the CrossFit athlete. I was in great shape,
the best shape of my life. I'd need to be.
You ladies have a nice night, Mr. Today Growth said.
They turned to leave, but not before the blonde glanced back and gave me another grin. Devin laughed, but it sounded stilted.
Look at you getting all the attention.
I think they were more interested in you, I said, trying to be diplomatic.
Bullshit, Devin said. He liked what he saw. And you do look great, Andrea.
She sort of threw the last compliment away. Well, working out 5 days a week and being under constant stress will do that.
So the Rainier trip is still on?
Yeah, I said, and felt a pang of guilt. She raised her glass.
To having younger men hit on us in a bar.
I raised my glass and met hers, then pretended to take a drink, but only tasted the sugar around the rim. She set down her drink.
So, you and Graham are staying together?
I don't know, I said.
Can I speak frankly?
Sure, I said. I'd never known Devin not to speak frankly. She turned and glanced at the two men who'd tried to hit on us.
That's pretty much what's out there. Guys too young, looking to get laid, or divorced guys too old, looking to get laid. I know you and Graham have had your problems, but if he's willing to give your marriage a go, you might want to consider it. At the very least, go on the trip and see what comes of it. If it doesn't go well, then you can decide what to do.
I didn't get much of a chance to consider her advice. The waitress returned with our appetizers and another round of lemon drops.
We didn't order a second round, Devin said.
The waitress nodded at the table shared by our two admirers.
They sent them over.
The blonde and his friend raised their beer glasses and smiled. Devin said,
What do you think? Should we invite them over?
Sure, why not? I said, sensing she wanted to flirt with them. They turned out to be interns at an investment firm. Both were in graduate school, one at Tulane and the other at Dartmouth. Devin called them smarty pants. The blonde had definitely chosen me, and I talked with him long enough to keep his friend interested, for Devin's sake. At some point, Devin noticed that I hadn't drunk my first drink, and she finished it. She also drank my second drink. 4 lemon drops. Around 11 p.m., the guy hitting on Devin suggested they leave, and she agreed. I told his friend I was going to be heading home, and he didn't push it. He'd noticed the wedding ring. He said it was nice talking to me, and went back to the table with his other friends. Devin told her date she'd find him, and he too went back to his table. She looked at me and smiled.
You'll be okay getting home?
I could tell from her slurred speech that she was pretty wasted.
Of course, I said.
You sure you're all right?
I'm fine. The buzz will make the sex better.
Be careful.
Careful, I'm getting laid. But first I have to pee.
She grabbed her purse, which she'd hung by the strap over the back of her chair, and set it on the table along with her cell phone.
Watch my stuff?
Sure.
Right back.
She slid from her chair, stumbled when she hit the floor, but managed to remain upright.
Whoa. Maybe I shouldn't have had that 3rd lemon drop.
4, I thought, but didn't say.
You sure you're okay?
I asked again. She winked and weaved her way through the tables and the crowd, leaving me alone. I almost pulled out the paperback I carried in my purse, but knew how lame that would look. I surveyed the crowd, my gaze passing over the tables of couples to the group of men standing at the upright table drinking their beers and laughing. Mr. Today Growth watched Devin cross the bar, looking anxious or excited. I couldn't tell. My eyes paused on Brad Pitt. In my fantasy, he looked over at me, and I didn't look away. In my fantasy, I stuck my finger in my glass, swirling the drink, then brought my finger seductively to my lips and nibbled on the tip. Devin's cell phone buzzed. When I looked down, the phone on the table was neither lit up nor vibrating. It took a second before I realized the noise was coming from inside her purse, which was unzipped. Confused, I looked inside and saw a second phone. The face lit up a pale blue-green. Caller ID did not provide a name, but I didn't need a name. I recognized the number. A rush of anxiety hit me so violently the legs of my chair rattled. Nauseated, like I'd been punched in the gut, I fought the urge to throw up. I looked again. Graham. What the hell? What possible reason could there be for Graham to be calling Devon? To my knowledge, they hardly knew each other. And why would she have a second phone? I fought to control my breathing, to regain some semblance of composure, and to think through what I was witnessing. The gravity and believability of it all. I thought of the credit card charges to the hotels and restaurants in Seattle when Graham said he'd been away on business. Could that have been Devon? Was she the woman he was having an affair with? The credit card bills included the dates Graham had been gone. His cell phone bill would show his calls and the dates he made them, but I didn't know the number of the phone in Devon's purse. Still, it wouldn't be too difficult to figure it out. I looked over my shoulder, saw no sign of Devon, reached inside her purse and grabbed the phone. The screen indicated she'd received multiple text messages from the same number. Graham's cell phone. Only partial messages appeared on the screen. Hey, hoping to get... Just got to... Did you talk to... I couldn't unlock Devon's phone without the password to read the full messages. I also couldn't determine the phone number. But I didn't need to. I looked over my shoulder to the hallway on the other side of the bar and watched Devon emerge, walking toward the table. I dropped the phone back inside the purse, slid from my bar stool and put on my jacket.
"You all set?"
Devon asked, grabbing her purse and her jacket.
"Yeah," I said. "I'm tired."
She paused when she went to zip closed her purse, no doubt seeing the last registered call on the phone. Maintaining a poker face, she calmly dropped her regular phone inside her purse and zipped it closed. She reached out and gave me a warm hug. My entire body tensed.
"So, let me guess, you're heading home to stick your nose in a book."
"You know me," I said.
"Like a book,"
Devon said, laughing. Then she turned and walked toward the table where the guy awaited her. "Except you're reading the wrong book," I said to her back. I was no longer going home. I was going to the office to stick my nose in Devon Chambers's computer. Chapter 21. At first, Vic Fazio thought he was having one of those anxiety dreams in which everything feels stilted and magnified. An annoying insect circled his head, buzzing loudly. He couldn't swat it or otherwise make it stop. Then his subconscious gave way to instincts he had honed over decades, a cop conditioned to being awakened at odd hours. He realized the insect was his cell phone. He turned the ringer off at night so as not to disturb Vera, who was a light sleeper. But that didn't keep the phone from buzzing and shaking on his bedside nightstand. Foz didn't need to open his eyes to know it was still the middle of the night. His inner clock, honed as a parent of two boys, told him. He felt Vera roll away from him, onto her side, well acclimated to life as the spouse of a homicide detective. Except just then, something else became clear. Foz and Dell were not the homicide team on call. They had been working the Andrea Strickland murder, but that case got pulled last Thursday. Foz reached blindly, missing the phone the first time before finding it. He brought it up in front of his face, the numbers blurry without his glasses, but he could make out only the local 206 Seattle area code. He hit the green button.
"Hello?"
His voice sounded like he was speaking through a drain pipe clogged with pea gravel and water. He cleared his throat.
"Hello?"
"Hey, Foz, how's it going?"
"What?"
he said, confused. "How's it going?"
"Who the hell is this?"
"Who is it?" Vera asked, rolling toward him and sitting up. "Did something happen to one of the kids?"
"It's Nick," the caller said. "Your favorite skip tracer."
Foz struggled to sit up. Vera turned on the light on her side of the bed. The two of them squinted at the brightness.
"Nick?"
Foz asked, looking at the nightstand clock radio.
"Who's Nick?" Vera asked.
"What the hell time is it?" Foz said.
"It's 3:32.
"In the morning?"
Nick laughed.
"Hey, April Fools, Fazio."
"Son of a bitch," Foz said under his breath.
"What is wrong with you? My wife is worried sick something happened to one of the kids."
"Yeah, and my wife is still pissed at me for throwing your cell phones in the damn lake. So maybe now we have a truce." Foz blew out a heavy breath, looked at Vera, and said,
"I'm sorry, it's a business call."
"At this hour?"
Foz knew he deserved it. He spoke into the phone. "This is the only reason you called? To even the score?" "Come on, Foz, I'm an asshole, but I'm not that big an asshole. I got some information for you on that job you asked me to look into. For free."
"Strickland?"
"Yeah."
"Okay," Foz said, reaching for his reading glasses and the pen and pad of paper he also kept on the nightstand.
"Go ahead." "Shit, Fazio, it's 3:30 in the morning. Call me later and we'll set a time and place to talk."
"Wait, are you telling me you called just to wake me up?"
"That would be vindictive, Foz."
He paused. Then he said,
"I'm a night owl, in case you think of being funny again."
Nick hung up.
"Who was that?"
Vera asked, still looking worried.
"You know how you're always telling me I'm not as funny as I think I am?"
"Yeah?"
"You're right."
When Foz called later that morning, Ian Nikolic told him to meet for lunch at Duke's Chowder House. Duke's was located at the end of a pier on Lake Union.
"Does this guy do anything that doesn't involve the water?"
Dell said, as the waitress led them through the restaurant to the wood deck out back. Nick sat beneath the shade of white umbrellas shielding the tables, talking on his cell phone. The other tables were full, diners dressed in light shirts and summer dresses, enjoying a breeze off the lake that made the temperature tolerable, though Foz could already feel trickles of sweat beneath his shirt.
"I'm going to have to call you back," Nikolic said, holding the phone to his ear, half standing and reaching out a hand to Foz. "My lunch guests just arrived."
"Yeah."
"Yeah, today."
"I told you I'll get to it today."
He disconnected and shook Foz's hand.
"Hey, Fazio. You're looking a little tired. Didn't you get a good night's sleep?"
Dell laughed and removed his sport coat.
"Yeah, all right, you got me. Now we're even. Vera nearly kicked me out of bed, she was so mad."
They settled into seats. Three chairs had a view of the dazzling blue water teeming with boats and yachts leaving and returning to the marina. But Dell draped his jacket over the back of the chair facing away from the water.
"You got something against natural beauty?" Nick said.
"That's what the doctor said to his mother when he was born," Foz said.
"I'm good right where I am," Dell said.
The waiter appeared, handing them menus. Foz ordered an iced tea.
"Make mine an Arnold Palmer," Dell said.
"Get the chowder," Nick said, not bothering to open his menu. "You can't go wrong."
Foz and Nick ordered the chowder.
"And a loaf of bread," Foz said. "I'm a big dipper."
"Scallop ravioli," Dell said, considering the menu.
"Look at that, Foz. They got seafood for Italians."
He looked up at the waiter.
"Is it good?"
The waiter assured him it was. After the waiter departed, Foz sipped his water.
"So what do you got for me, Nick?"
"Someone was looking for that name you came asking about."
"Andrea Strickland?"
"No.
Lynn Hoff."
"Yeah,"
Foz glanced at Dell. Only someone who knew Andrea Strickland had created an alias would have known to ask about Lynn Hoff.
"Do we know who?"
"No,
and the guy I got the information from is jumpy as all hell, given what happened to her. He said he'd tell me everything so long as I leave his name out of it."
"That's gonna depend on what he told you, Nick. You know I can't make that promise," Foz said.
"I know, but he doesn't. I told him the same thing, but I also said I'd do my best to keep him out of it, act as a go-between. This is one of those instances when the information is more valuable than the source. Am I right?"
"So what did he have to say?"
Dell asked.
"Someone used a guerrilla email account to make contact. Ordinarily, he won't agree to work under those conditions."
"What's a guerrilla email?" Dell asked.
It's a disposable email address, Foz said. It's like a burner phone for email. People use it when they don't want to use their real name or email address. A random address is generated each time the person logs in, and the email is automatically deleted an hour after it's generated. He turned to Nikolic.
What did they want your guy to do?
Nick shrugged.
Asked him to find someone named Lynn Hoff. Said he was a relative.
So we don't know if this person doing the asking was a man or a woman? Dell said. Nikolic shook his head.
No way to know.
So how does the person on your end get information back to an email address that gets deleted after an hour? Dell asked.
They set up a time to communicate. The client told my guy he'd send another email in 72 hours, and if my guy had any information, he could email him back. Personally, I like to know who I'm dealing with, and won't work that way. But not everyone has my same high degree of integrity, Nick smiled.
So what did your guy find? Foz asked.
He ran the name through the usual channels and came up with the same Washington State driver's license you found. He also ran a credit report and found the name associated with an apartment complex in Oklahoma, along with utility records and a request for installation of a phone in that name for that address.
I'm assuming that was a false trail, Foz said.
Turned out it was.
So the person knew what they were doing? Dell asked.
Hell, you can read it in books now or watch YouTube, Nikolic said. Internet is going to put us all out of business eventually. Computers will take over the world. But yeah, the person had clearly done some research or knew what they were doing.
The skip tracer give the client this information? Foz asked.
He did. The client then said the person might be using a second alias, Nikolic said. He glanced down at his notes in a spiral notebook. Devin Chambers. He told my guy he might want to start in Portland, Oregon.
Devin Chambers, Dell said.
That's the name the client gave him.
Isn't she Strickland's friend? Dell said to Foz.
What did he find? Foz asked Nick. He ran the name through the system and came up with a driver's license and an apartment in Portland. My guy takes a drive down to Portland and talks to the neighbors. She'd lived there, but the tenants said they hadn't seen her in a few weeks. Two said she told them she was taking an extended trip out of the country.
Did she keep the lease? Foz asked.
It was month to month. When she didn't pay, the landlord went through the channels and evicted her.
What did the landlord do with all her possessions?
Put everything in storage. She never came back for it.
So she didn't care about it, Foz said. Doesn't appear she did.
Foz gave that some thought. He asked, Did Chambers tell any of the tenants where she was going?
One thought she said Europe. A long-overdue backpacking trip.
She asked one of her neighbors to collect her mail while she was gone. Neighbor still has a big stack of it.
She didn't ask the neighbor to forward it, Foz said.
Nope.
He looked to Dell.
Sounds like she didn't intend to come back, but she didn't want it to look that way.
Definitely, Dell said.
Nikolic checked his notebook again. The skip tracer tracked down a relative in New Jersey, a married sister, Allison McCabe. He spelled the last name. He called her, said he was the building manager, and told her he had Devin Chambers' furniture, personal belongings, and a stack of mail, but didn't know where to forward it.
What did the sister tell him?
Nikolic smiled. She said she hadn't had any contact with her sister in several years and didn't know what to tell him. The sister didn't want anything to do with her. He pressed her a bit and learned Devin Chambers has a fondness for prescription drugs and a related money management problem. She'd apparently borrowed money from the sister in the past and never repaid it. The sister got tired of it and cut her off. According to my guy, a lot of the mail collected was from creditors and collection agencies, past due.
Disappearing takes money, Foz said.
Dell looked to Foz.
The trust fund.
I'm thinking the same thing, Foz said. Just wondering if the skip tracer knew. If Chambers and Andrea were pals, maybe Andrea was helping her out.
Dell shook his head. Then why wouldn't she just give her the money to pay her bills? That seems a lot simpler solution than both of them running.
Except Andrea needed to get away, Foz said. Needed people to think she died.
Sounds like Chambers had reason to disappear also.
Maybe they worked out a deal.
Foz looked to Nikolich.
Your guy find anything else?
He had a woman in his office call up Chambers' last employer and ask for the person who did the payroll. She pretended to be Chambers and said she hadn't received her final check and just wanted to confirm the forwarding address they had for her.
Did they have one? Foz asked.
Nikolich nodded. A Dropbox inside a Bartels drugstore in Renton, Washington. But the name on the box wasn't Devin Chambers.
Another big smile.
It was Lynn Hoff.
No shit, Foz said.
No shit. So the skip tracer has the same woman call the pharmacy, pretend to be Lynn Hoff, and asks if they have her insurance information on her profile. The pharmacy technician rattles off the same P.O. box. The woman asks if her doctor had called in her most recent prescription, and the tech says they have nothing since they filled a prescription for oxycodone a week earlier.
Confirming Lynn Hoff was still in the area.
And your guy passed all this on to the client with the gorilla email account? Foz asked.
He did.
And if a person was so inclined, they could stake out that Bartels and hope Devin Chambers, or Andrea Strickland, walks in, follows her when she leaves, and find out where she's staying.
Nikolich sat back, sipping his drink.
That's what I would have done, he said.
Tracy and Kins were in the car when Dell and Foz called. They said they had information but didn't want to share it at the office. Tracy said she and Kins would meet them in the food court in the plaza of the Bank of America building on Fifth Avenue. Over coffee, Tracy and Kins listened to Foz and Dell explain what Nikolich had told them.
Awfully big coincidence for Devin Chambers to show up in the same city in Washington where Andrea Strickland goes to get a face rearranged and do her banking, Foz said.
Too big, Tracy said.
They were friends, Kin said. So Devin Chambers had to be the person who helped her off the mountain, and maybe the person who looked after Strickland after the surgery.
And Strickland would have needed prescription drugs for the pain, Foz said.
Or Chambers was after the trust money, Tracy said.
They all looked at her.
She said, according to the sister, Devin Chambers had a prescription drug problem and a money problem, right?
That's what he said, Foz said.
So she could have been after both, Tracy said.
And if Devin Chambers was helping Andrea Strickland, she'd have known Andrea Strickland's alias as well as the bank, and probably the accounts and the passwords.
You think she could have killed her? Kins asked. Then moved the money?
Tracy shrugged.
Strickland was already dead. Chambers would have known that, too. It was the perfect crime, so long as nobody ever found the body.
So maybe we should be looking for Devin Chambers, Foz said.
Not our case anymore, Kin said, finishing the last of his coffee.
Tracy had not told any of them about San Bernardino, and what she'd learned from Penny Orr or from the counselor, Alan Townsend. If the shit hit the fan about Tracy continuing the investigation, she wanted them to be able to say they had no knowledge of any of her actions.
"I'll call Stan Fields," she said. "I'll tell him it was something we had going on when the investigation was pulled, that we just now got the information and we're passing it on."
"Nick won't give up his source," Foz said.
"That's not our problem," Ken said.
"Let Fields deal with it, if he decides to push it."
Tracy wondered how much Fields would push it.
Chapter 22. Tracy called Stan Fields that afternoon and told him he was going to want to meet her. She suggested Wednesday, July 5th, her day off. When Fields pressed her for a reason for the meeting, she remained vague, but said it would be worth the drive north to Seattle. She suggested they meet at Cactus, a restaurant on Alki Beach. If ever questioned about the meeting, it would be easier for her to explain a lunch on her day off at a restaurant near her home
rather than try to explain why she would drive all the way to Tacoma for an investigation she was no longer supposed to be working. Wednesday, at just minutes after noon, Tracy sat waiting beneath the green and red awnings on the cactus patio, munching chips and salsa and sipping iced tea. Across the street, people packed the beach and the Alki Beach boardwalk, so much so that runners had to venture into the street to avoid the crowd. Judging from the heavy car traffic, still more were coming to enjoy the beach or to have lunch in one of the restaurants with the billion-dollar view. Tourists clustered around the concrete obelisk commemorating what was supposedly the birthplace of Seattle, or at least the location where the Denny Party settlers landed in the fall of 1851 to establish the first settlement. Native Americans already living in the area likely would dispute that the area needed finding. Tracy watched Fields approach the patio from along 63rd Avenue, which ran perpendicular to Alki Avenue. He sucked on a cigarette. The 70s motif continued. Fields wore a gray pinstriped suit, open-collared shirt displaying a gold chain, and aviator sunglasses. Tracy had dressed casually in shorts, a blue tank top, and white shirt. Fields took a final pull on the cigarette before dropping it and grinding it with his shoe. Inside the restaurant, he greeted her.
"Traffic is a bitch around here. Good call on the parking."
Living close by, Tracy knew the secret parking locations, like the underground garage directly adjacent to the building.
"Don't these people freaking work?"
Fields said, eyeing the mass of bodies walking the boardwalk across the street. "It's lunchtime," Tracy said. "People in the Northwest know to get out when the sun's shining. The fall and winter can be very long." Fields removed his jacket and pulled out his chair, sitting. He smelled of cigarette smoke.
"In Arizona, you stay indoors in the summer and venture out in the fall and winter."
He removed his aviator sunglasses, folded them, and put them in his shirt pocket. When the waitress approached, he said,
"Bring me a Corona with a lime, darling."
Tracy fought to keep her tongue in check. Fields directed his attention to Tracy.
"So, why all the intrigue?"
"No intrigue. I have some information for you on the Andrea Strickland case, a few things we were working when they pulled jurisdiction."
"No intrigue."
Fields gave Tracy a shit-eating grin. The mustache ends lifted.
"Judging from your appearance, you're not working today. You have information for me not in the file you shipped down, but you didn't want to discuss it over the phone, and you asked me to come to you. I've been doing this job a while also."
"Yeah, I know. It's not your first rodeo," Tracy said.
"So you got the file?"
Fields nodded.
"I had another chat with Graham Strickland, or I should say I tried."
He's lawyered up. The mustache twitched.
"Everything has to go through the attorney. I told the attorney we'd charge him and his client with obstruction."
Tracy could only imagine how far that tactic had gotten Fields.
"He told me to put up or shut up," he continued. "We compromised. He's going to make Strickland available for questioning."
Fields sat back, watching two young women in shorts walk past the patio before redirecting his attention to Tracy.
"Not sure how much good it's going to do, since we can't get an exact time on the murder, and there are no forensics to speak of with the salt water doing a number on the crab pot and body. Even if we found the gun, which is less than doubtful, we don't have a bullet. We're working to get Strickland's credit card and phone records to see if maybe he rented a crabbing boat for the day. Not likely."
Fields took a chip, dipped it in the salsa, and popped it in his mouth.
"In other words, it remains circumstantial, and the little prick knows it."
The waitress returned with Fields's beer, a lime slice sticking out the neck. "Are you ready to order?" she asked.
"Just bring me that steak dish you have," Fields said. "What's it called? Carne asada, am I right?"
The woman smiled. "How do you like it cooked?"
"Blood red. You tell the chef I want it to moo when I stick it with my fork, and throw a couple of them big green peppers on the grill for me also."
Tracy ordered a tostada. No sour cream or guacamole, she said. Field shoved the lime slice into the bottle.
Watching your frigger?
He took a sip of his beer.
So what do you have for me?
Tracy dipped a chip, munching. I spoke to Andrea Strickland's aunt in San Bernardino.
Yeah?
Field said, sounding surprised and irritated.
What? You just happen to be down there? Like you just happen to want to spend your day off work in a case no longer yours? Don't they keep you busy up here in Seattle?
Field's eyebrows drew together. I also spoke to her counselor, Tracy said, ignoring him.
Strickland's or the aunt's?
Strickland's. The aunt took Andrea to see him after the car accident that killed her parents. She continued when she realized her husband was molesting Andrea.
No shit,
Field said, loud enough for heads to turn at the other tables. Tracy sipped her iced tea. The kid loses her parents in a car accident, then has to endure crap like that.
Not everyone grew up in the Brady Bunch, Field said, taking another sip of his beer.
Yeah, far from it, Tracy said.
So she was all screwed up, Field said.
Counselor called protective services and she was removed from the home until the aunt moved to a new place.
Charges pressed?
I haven't looked.
What happened to her?
Counselor isn't certain, but said it is entirely plausible Andrea could have developed what he called a dissociative disorder. Multiple personalities she might take on to avoid the real world.
Sort of like that Sybil movie?
I wouldn't know.
Did he name any of these other personalities?
You mean like Lynn Hoff?
No.
But he said Andrea was an obsessive reader and could have taken on the role of the characters in the book she read.
Let's hope she didn't read Carrie, Field said. Sounds like she was a train wreck waiting to happen.
Maybe. He also said she could have been prone to violent acts.
You ever witness that?
Tracy shook her head. Andrea left when she turned 18. He said the symptoms likely would manifest, if they were going to manifest, in her early 20s.
So she could have been a time bomb waiting to go off. Did he say what could set her off?
He speculated on a number of things. Another trauma, abuse, abandonment, or if she felt desperate. The waitress returned with Tracy's tostada and Fields's carne asada. He stuck it with his fork.
I don't hear no mooing, he said.
The waitress looked concerned.
Don't you worry about it, darling. I'm just playing with you. Bring me another Corona, will you?
The waitress took the empty bottle from the table. Fields grabbed his knife and cut at the meat, putting a hunk in his mouth and talking as he chewed.
You said abandon, like if her husband was cheating on her or planning on killing her, and she found out?
Possibly.
Okay. So where does this get me?
Tracy spooned some salsa onto her tostada. Well, it could explain how a seemingly introverted young woman walked off that mountain in the first place and went to such extremes to set her husband up to look like he'd murdered her. Fields lowered his knife and fork.
What do you mean, set him up?
According to your report, the husband had no knowledge of the insurance policy naming him a beneficiary.
That's what he said, but we both know that's probably bullshit, Fields said.
Maybe not, Tracy said. No confirmation on the girlfriend. Andrea was convinced her husband was sleeping with either. What we do know is she walked off the mountain, but not before she left the debris field of clothes and equipment, which means she had to have brought an extra set to get down the mountain. She didn't carry all that up there for the hell of it. And she obtained a fake driver's license, which all points to premeditation.
So you're saying she got the insurance policy to make it look like the husband was trying to kill her?
Or maybe he was trying to kill her and she found out, Tracy said. But yeah, getting the policy, consulting a divorce attorney, telling her boss she suspected her husband was cheating on her again, all could have been part of a plan to leave a trail of breadcrumbs leading right back to her husband.
She doesn't strike me as that smart, especially if she was as big a nut job as the shrink says.
Bundy was a nut job. Tracy let that sink in for a moment. According to Andrea's boss, she was very bright. Fields put down his knife and fork and wiped the corners of his mouth with his napkin.
Okay. But the question is, who killed her now? And, assuming you're right about all of this, that she somehow did find out the husband's plan to kill her and she set him up, it would all be reason why he might seek her out and kill her. So we're back to the husband.
Possibly. Though I'd still put his desire to get at the trust fund as the more likely motivation, if he did it. Which brings me to the next thing I wanted to talk to you about. Someone was looking for Lynn Hoff, and for Devon Chambers.
How do you know that?
I asked a friend in the business of finding people to ask around and let me know if anyone was looking for Lynn Hoff. Someone was.
Someone who?
He doesn't know. The client used a guerrilla email account to ensure they remained anonymous.
So that's a dead end.
Not necessarily. The waitress returned with Fields' second beer and refilled Tracy's glass of iced tea. Tracy waited until she'd departed. My contact said the person initially asked the skip tracer to search for a Lynn Hoff, but other than the Washington State driver's license we found, he also came up empty. Field squeezed the lime onto his steak, then shoved the rind into the bottle.
Right. So other than now knowing someone was looking for her, it's a dead end.
It means someone knew Andrea changed her identity to Lynn Hoff, Tracy said, feeling like she was spoon-feeding Fields his investigation, and no longer surprised that the initial investigation had not produced results. And, when the skip tracer advised that the usual channels were not bringing up anything on a Lynn Hoff, this unknown client threw out the name Devon Chambers.
He knew the name?
Apparently.
And Devon Chambers disappeared about the same time Andrea Strickland disappeared, Field said. That's what the employer said, right?
Tracy had included that information in her report of the interview of Brenda Berg. Chambers told her neighbors she was leaving town for Europe. She asked someone at the complex to collect her mail, but made no attempt to recover it or her belongings. Apparently she has a sister in New Jersey who said Devon has a money management problem likely related to a prescription drug problem.
You think she was after Andrew's money?
The skip tracer found an address for a P.O. box inside a drugstore in Renton registered to a Lynn Hoff. The pharmacy also had a record of at least one prior prescription under that name. And Renton is where Andrea Strickland used the name Lynn Hoff to have her face reconstructed and did her banking.
You think they were working together? Chambers and Strickland?
That's one way of looking at it. There might be another. The ranger I spoke with was convinced Strickland had help getting off the mountain and getting away. Also, 2 days after Kurt Schill pulled the body up in the crab pot, somebody drained Lynn Hoff's bank accounts, which means that person had to know the bank, the account numbers, and the passwords.
Right, so you're thinking this Devon Chambers helped her off the mountain and either was working with her or conned her and eventually killed her?
Tracy wasn't going to go that far. She wasn't going to draw conclusions from evidence she wasn't supposed to have on an investigation she was no longer directing. I think she might be a person of interest you'd want to talk with. Fields picked up his beer and sat back, sipping it.
So how come none of this is in your reports?
Tracy shrugged. Like I said, we didn't have it yet. Just came in.
There's no mention of an aunt or a shrink in your file. No mention you'd put word out on the street asking if anyone was looking for Lynn Hoff. There's no mention of it as work in progress.
We were told to close the file and get it down to you guys, then finish up anything we were working on. What difference does it make? You have it now. Field set down his beer and lifted his napkin from his lap, placing it on his plate, though he hadn't finished his carne asada. He clearly wasn't happy Tracy had stepped on his investigation. Tracy didn't care. She didn't give a damn about Fields' feelings. She cared about finding a killer. Field spotted the waitress, made eye contact, and motioned for the check. He re-engaged Tracy.
Thanks for the information. And the lunch.
Tracy shook her head. Your rodeo, she said.
your credit card.
When Tracy arrived home after her lunch with Stan Fields, Dan was sitting outside on one of the two chaise longue on the deck. Far from baking beneath the heat of an unrelenting sun, he looked comfortable in the broad shade of a freestanding patio umbrella. As Tracy stepped out onto the deck, Dan set down a legal pleading, bleeding red from the pen in his hand. Rex and Sherlock, who looked like they'd died and found heaven in the same shade, saw her approach, but only Sherlock got up to greet her, tail whipping the air. Tracy didn't blame Rex, who gave her a sheepish eyebrow raise. Dan looked up from behind round, wire-framed glasses that gave him a professorial look, but now would forever be associated with Harry Potter. He'd gone into the office early to catch up on paperwork and make sure there were no fires burning so they could spend the afternoon together. "When did we get that?" Tracy asked. The umbrella was not only big, but a hideous rust color, though she refrained from saying so. "It's great, isn't it? I bought it on the way home from the office. I figured with the weather this nice, there was no need to spend the day working inside. Plus, you're supposed to stay out of the sun."
"I'm supposed to wear sunscreen," she said.
Never thought I'd see the day we'd be buying umbrellas in Seattle that had nothing to do with rain.
"Global warming," he said.
"Glaciers melting, oceans rising, drought, famine, dogs and cats living together."
"Are we getting our meteorology from Bill Murray now?" she asked, fairly certain the last part of Dan's sentence was a ripoff from a line in one of the comedian's movies.
"Where were you? Did you go for a walk?" Dan asked.
She sipped from his glass of ice water.
"No, I had a meeting."
"On your day off?"
She sat on the edge of the adjacent chaise longue, facing him. "I met with the detective from Pierce County, who took over the woman in the crab pot investigation."
"On your day off?" he asked again.
"I thought you couldn't stand the guy."
She turned her attention to the view.
"There was some information I had to give him, off the record."
"On your day off?" Dan said again.
"Is this going to be a discussion of my being obsessed with solving every murder involving a young woman because of what happened to my sister?"
"No."
"Then why do you keep saying that?" she said, aggravated. Dan set down the pleading and took a breath. "You told me the world crapped on this young woman. That she went from being the daughter of a doctor to an orphan being molested by an uncle to the wife of an abusive husband."
"That's true," she said.
"So I'm wondering if your trip to San Bernardino has anything to do with you feeling some kind of connection to her."
"Why? Do you plan to abuse me?"
"I'm afraid of you, you know that." He smiled to lighten the mood. "Look, I'm just saying that we both know life didn't exactly play fair with you either, Tracy. Your dad was a doctor, and you lost him and your sister very near to each other."
"I'm not going to wallow in pity, Dan."
"I'm not saying you should."
"I had a vested interest in this case," she said, thinking of Nolasco. "It was my investigation, and yeah, you know, sometimes they are personal. Aren't some of your cases more personal than others?"
"Sure. But in what percentage of those investigations that you make personal is the victim a young woman?"
"A lot," she said. "Because a lot of the people abducted and killed are young women. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do about that."
"When it's your case, I don't think there's anything you need to do about it. I'm sure it motivates you to do a better job. But when it's not your case and you make bad decisions, then I think you have to question your motivation."
"All I did was follow up on some things. How is that a bad decision?"
"Your trip to San Bernardino was unauthorized."
"It wasn't a business trip."
"Really?"
"Look, I talked to her while you were in court and passed the information on to the detective taking back the investigation. It's in his hands now. He gets the credit for good police work. I don't see that as making a bad decision."
"So you're going to let it go?"
"I have to. Don't I?"
They sat in silence. Dan stood.
"Okay. I have a few errands to run."
She knew she was being defensive, and she knew Dan was only looking out for her.
She also knew she had trouble letting things go. She got up and hugged him.
I'm sorry. I don't want to fight about this.
Yeah, okay. I feel something for this woman, and I wanted to see it through.
You're right.
There's definitely a connection there, and I'm pissed we didn't keep it, and I'm sorry if I'm taking that out on you.
Don't worry about it, he said. I'm a big boy.
Listen, I'll be out most of the afternoon finishing a few things, but we could take the dogs out later when the temperature cools.
Sure, she said. I'd like that.
He started inside, then turned back. Oh, and I talked to my doctor about what we discussed the other day on our run.
The vasectomy?
He says it can be reversed. She knew it was a lot to ask of Dan. Not just the procedure, which would be a day or two of pain, but the lifetime commitment to being a parent. She didn't want him to feel pressure simply because of her own sudden anxiety that she might never have a child.
Take me out of the equation for a moment, she said.
Would you still want to have children?
I can't take you out of the equation, he said.
I'm in love with you. I wouldn't do it for any other person. The question is really one you have to answer. I hate to sound like a chauvinist, but since God didn't give me a uterus, or breasts for that matter, the heavy lifting is going to fall on you for at least the first year. Are you sure you've thought this through?
I always thought I'd have children, she said.
I know, he said, and live in Cedar Grove next door to Sarah, and we'd all get together on Sundays for barbecues, and our children would go to school together. She smiled, but a tear escaped the corner of her eye.
You thought about that?
We were best friends, he said, embracing her, and that was our world. They're good memories, Tracy.
They don't have to be sad memories.
Now we have the chance to make our own memories, together.
I'm not sure I deserve that chance, she said.
He pulled back, looking down at her.
Why would you say something like that?
Because of Sarah?
She fought back tears.
She's never going to fall in love, Dan. Never going to get married or raise children.
He hugged her.
It wasn't your fault what happened to her, Tracy. You know that.
Yes, she knew it, but that didn't make her feel better about it. Sarah was always in the back of her mind.
I still think about her. That I never should have let her drive home alone.
What do you think Sarah would want for you?
Tracy wiped her tears. More quickly followed.
I know she'd want me to be happy, Tracy said.
Of course she would.
She wept, head on Dan's chest. When she'd regained her composure, she pulled back and said,
I think it's like you said the other day, that we shouldn't take the second step until we've taken the first step.
Dan released her hand.
There's that proposal again. He made a goofy face.
I know I'm a stud and all, but really you're going to have to sweep me off my feet.
Tracy laughed and playfully hit his chest.
Okay, he said. We'll take it one step at a time.
He checked the clock on the inside wall. I have a few more hours of work and some errands, and when I get back we can take Rex and Sherlock down to the beach.
Tracy smiled.
I'd like that. Just after 7, with the temperature pleasant and a light breeze blowing from the north, Dan loaded Rex and Sherlock into the back of his SUV.
We're not going to walk? Tracy asked.
I think they're still hurting a bit from their run the other day. I'm still hurting from the run the other day.
They don't look like they're hurting.
Sherlock and Rex pranced with excitement, whining, tongues hanging out.
They would run until they dropped, Dan said.
We can drive down and get a walk on the beach. I want to go out to the lighthouse.
Okay, Tracy said, sliding into the passenger seat.
Dan drove down the hill and around the bend. Normally, with parking difficult in the summer, they pulled into a designated lane in the middle of the road. But today, Dan drove past the storefronts and restaurants, out toward the lighthouse.
"Are we going to walk the dogs or drive them?" Tracy asked.
Dan turned right into a parking lot just past the V-shaped apartment complex that led to the Alki Point Lighthouse. A cyclone gate on wheels blocked the entrance, and a large sign warned that the area was restricted and trespassers would be prosecuted. "It's closed," she said, not sure what Dan was expecting at that hour.
"Huh," Dan said. "Let's see if there's a way down to the water."
"Are we looking to get arrested to spice up the day?" Tracy asked. Smaller signs posted in the parking lot indicated the parking was reserved for apartment tenants and violators would be towed.
"I've never been out here," Dan said. "I just want to take a look. The worst they'll do is ask us to leave."
He stepped from the car and opened the tailgate. Rex and Sherlock bounded out and followed him to the cyclone fence. Dan pulled on the gate, and the fence rolled to the left.
"It's open," he said.
"No, it's closed," she said, still anchored in her seat. "You opened it."
"Come on, let's just take a look. They would have locked it if they didn't want anyone to come in."
"You won't be satisfied until we're arrested, will you?"
"Don't be a namby-pants.
Wasn't I just getting a lecture about doing things that might get me in trouble?"
"That was different. You could lose your job. What are they going to do to us for looking?"
"Arrest us? Accuse us of being terrorists? Send us to Guantanamo Bay? Waterboards?"
"Come on," Dan said. He walked away, down the street.
"Okay," Tracy said, opening her door and stepping out. "I guess we're doing this."
She closed the gate behind her and hurried to catch up.
The paved road continued past two homes, white with red roofs and porches. The homes reminded her of something out of a 1950s movie. The Seattle Times had recently run an article commemorating the lighthouse's 100th anniversary and noted that the two beachfront homes now housed senior Coast Guard officers. Farther down the road, Tracy and Dan came to maintenance buildings, also white, with red roofs. A white gravel path led to the lighthouse, which marked the tip of the southern entrance and the transition from Puget Sound into Elliott Bay. Tracy followed Dan along the gravel path, half expecting armed guards to appear at any moment and order them to the ground. The door to the lighthouse remained open. Dan stepped inside. Tracy followed. The room at floor level consisted of a museum with photographs and equipment depicting the lighthouse's history. Dan didn't linger, climbing a narrow, winding staircase. Tracy followed him to the second level, figuring if they'd come this far, they might as well go all the way. A metal ladder ascended to the actual room that housed the light. They'd need a crane to get Rex and Sherlock up the ladder.
"Stay," Dan said.
Dan climbed the rungs. Tracy followed. Below, Rex whined.
"Hush," Dan said.
As Tracy climbed, she couldn't see above her. Dan blocked the entrance. When he reached the top and cleared the ladder, however, she noticed a flickering golden glow. She reached the top rung, and Dan extended a hand to help her into the cramped, octagon-shaped room, the light beacon in the middle. The glow, however, did not emanate from the beacon. It came from a dozen flickering candles, casting shadows over red roses. Out the windows, streams of light from the fading sun glistened on the surface of the water like hundreds of diamonds. Tracy felt her eyes water and her knees weaken. Dan never released her hand. He dropped to a knee while reaching into one of the pockets of his cargo shorts, producing a small black box.
"Oh my God,"
Tracy said, feeling herself becoming overwhelmed, tears streaming down her cheeks.
"Tracy Ann Crosswhite," Dan said, opening the box to display a large diamond. Her chest heaved and her breath caught in her throat. She covered her mouth with her hand.
"Will you marry me?" Dan asked. They sat at a table in their favorite Italian restaurant, just north of the point on Beach Drive. Out the window, the sunlight faded behind the islands and the distant Olympic Mountains. The red roses, now arranged in a vase, stood on the table, but Tracy couldn't take her eyes off the ring adorning her left hand, or the man who'd placed it there.
"It's so beautiful," she said.
Everything was so beautiful. How did you get this all done?
Well, at the risk of not starting this relationship off with complete honesty, I didn't go into the office this morning.
I figured that. How did you get them to let you use the lighthouse?
I have a friend who works with the Coast Guard and is tight with the commander. He had one